Down with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Here we go. It's a minute past the hour. This Thursday, the 30th day of October, 2014. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That is, of course, where you go to get into the chat room. Wander on by. Folks already have started to do so. Good evening, Anatole. Good evening, Jeremy. Good evening, R.L. Smith. Good evening, Texas T, and good evening, of course, to longtime, inveterate, indefatigable Horn chat room moderators Lottie and Sparky. More will be by presently, I am sure. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, the pop-out player, which is extra super-duper double-plus good handy for listening via a PC. There are links now, by the way, at the new HeadOnRadioNetwork.com to oodles and oodles and oodles of Horn podcasts. Isn't that cool? Yes. Also, of course, at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find the tab that says Contribute. And the use of that tab that says Contribute and the access to the PayPal interface that it provides is the means by which we keep this whole thing on the air. And we're in a hole as we run out the clock on October. Tonight's fundraising goal, because fundraising during the earlier part of the week has been less than, well, somewhat lackluster. Tonight's fundraising goal is $385. And when it gets to dire circumstances like that, well, that's when Sparky says pull the pin. And so the pin is pulled. You know, not on a grenade, on a fire extinguisher. We're putting out the fire. Yeah, so Sparky has $100 on the table this evening for anyone who wants to see it doubled. Now, here's the trick. It's got to get doubled in order, you know, I mean, that's the way challenges work. But it's there. And so, you know, you do 5, it becomes 10. You do 25, it becomes 50. You do 50, it becomes 100. The first 100 bucks that comes in, bang, right there, doubled. In any combination. So thank you very kindly to Sparky for the pull the pin challenge as we move into the end of October with the end of October, 1st of November bills waiting to be paid. So there we go. And, of course, if you want to use the traditional mail address, that's fine, too. It is, of course, The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, P.M.B. The Paul Mary Booger, Paul Mary Bravo. I can't, for the life of me, I can't remember those designations. With the P.M.B., I know it's Bravo. Anyway, P.M.B., 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801, with the gentle reminder that checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but should instead be made payable to The Horn, or Head On Communications, something like that. And that makes it possible for Boss Man Wayne to negotiate same. Okay, yeah, Papa Mike Bravo, okay. All I can ever remember is Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. And this being Thorn in the Side Thursday, we've got a Whiskey Tango Foxtrot for you. But it's visual. And it doesn't lend itself at all well to radio. And it will not, and nobody, and you're not going to see it if you're not on Facebook. Sorry. It's not mine to share around. I picked it up via the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Cold River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. On my Facebook page, oh my God, you will see a shining, almost electrifying example of why it is that the coal industry just makes us a little nervous around here. When I saw this earlier today and felt immediately compelled to post it on my own Facebook page, Bob Kincaid, the first thing I thought was, Sparky's going to have a fit. And then I remembered the call from our buddy Jay Cruzen a couple of nights ago, and I thought, yeah, Jay Cruzen's going to go into power swearing mode. You have to see it to believe it. Okay, so just go over to Facebook and have a look if you want. It's gotten some comments and shouldn't be too far down the page at this point in time. But I don't want to spoil it for anybody. But Jesus, the stupid! Hey, Cletus, go up there and fix that. But it is thorn in the side Thursday here at the Horn, and we reserve these things. For such days as this, but not just this. Thorn in the side Thursday. I just saw this in the chat room. Thank you, R.L. Smith. Roger. What the hell? I'll pull the pin on Sparky. If he has to send $100, I'll match it as long as he will send me some of those spicy nuts from last month. Okay, well, that works too. Thank you, Roger. And I guess we can say that the smoky ghost pepper cheese and pistachio challenge are still on the table. I need to check in with Sparky on that, but I'm guessing. But thank you, Roger. So that means we are now $200. Wait, could it be? Wow, thank you, Horst. We are now $250 toward the $385 hole we are in. Horst said, normally I like to get these in earlier in the month, but the end of the year is a really tough time. Glad to get it in, though. Thank you very kindly, Horst. Horst is a pillar. And, everyone who keeps this going is a pillar. I just wish there was some way to get some of these goodies overseas, but I'm guessing there isn't. Dang it. So, $250. So we're $135 away from coming up even with fundraising, which would be a real bonus at this point in time. Because it'll, we operate from month to month, and that's all there is to it. Back to business, as it were. This being Thorn in the Side Thursday, named, incidentally, by Horst. It's a back reference to Catch 22 by Joseph Heller. This being Thorn in the Side Thursday, Thorn in the Side Thursday is reserved for when we take note of the things that make us go, boom! Yeah. Robert in Morgantown noting, come on, Bob, that needs to be on YouTube. I have no control over that, but I do know that it comes by a Cold River Mountain Watch on their Facebook page. I don't know if it's on YouTube or not. I wouldn't begin to know how to tell you to find it if it is. It's just, wow. And if you want to try your hand at describing it in a conversation later, in the conversation radio portion of the program, you are more than welcome to attempt it. But no, our first thorn, and it really is, our first thorn comes via EcoWatch. You know how from time to time we will take note of something that has been broadcast over at NPR, and it is my want to refer to NPR as standing for National Petroleum Radio? I don't think it's even remotely a joke anymore. I think it's a reflection of reality. Why? EcoWatch, with a story from the 27th, NPR guts environmental team, leaving only one reporter. National Public Radio has slashed, gutted, virtually eliminated its environmental reporting desk. Remember when the New York Times did that a few months back, and we all said, how about that? How are we supposed to respond to this? I mean, you can't turn it on without finding out that some toxic profiteer has kindly contributed to the continuation of this broadcast. All right? At one point in time, they had three reporters and an editor working out of the NPR science desk. Now, they got one hanging by a thread. At the beginning of 2014, the NPR environmental unit was Richard Harris, Vicki Valentine, Elizabeth Shogren, and Chris Joyce. Richard Harris and Vicki Valentine have been reassigned into new roles at NPR. Elizabeth Shogren has just flat out gone, and poor lonely Chris Joyce remains at the environmental desk because, you know, you're a national public radio news network. So why would you want more than one human being covering the God knows thousands of potential environmental stories out there? Jesus. I love the excuse ponied up. Anastasia Pantsios at EcoWatch, made inquiry of Ann Gudenkoff, who is the senior supervising director of NPR's science desk, and Ann Gudenkoff, well, okay, I'm sorry, Catherine Bagley at EcoWatch, Inside Climate News, made the inquiry, Catherine Bagley did, and that's when Ann Gudenkoff said there are other issues of more interest. And well, you know, we don't feel that the environment needs dedicated reporters. I mean, other people cover it, too, alongside their regular beats. Yeah. Inside Climate News, Ms. Gudenkoff then went on to say, our coverage hasn't changed. I mean, the news about climate changes from week to week and month to month and year to year, and so does our coverage. Not so much. Inside Climate News then went on and analyzed the number of stories coming out of public radio on so-called environmental topics. At the beginning of the year, there was an average of about 60 or so stories per month, and that has now fallen off into the 40s. Yeah. Meanwhile, and this is part of the problem that we should probably discuss this. Inside Climate News, notice that what gets tagged environment over at NPR is a broad mix of pollution stories, wildlife stories. Shh, be very quiet. The wolverine, though fierce, is easily spooked. You know. Global health. I guess Ebola would fit. Oh, damn it, I said the word. If I say it two more times, Governor Paul LePage is going to appear in the studio and make me go to Maine and be quarantined. Frick. We'll talk about that later, too. Jesus. Agriculture stories get filed under environment. Land conservation stories get filed under environment. Meanwhile, there was piss-poor coverage of the People's Climate March this last month, September. And the public editor, the ombudsman for NPR, is a person named Edward Schumacher Matos, and this EcoWatch story points out the fact that when people complained to him that there was precious little coverage of this humongous hundreds of thousands of human beings march, well, Edward Schumacher Matos said, people just don't understand the nature of our coverage. I mean, we can't just cover something like that. You know, a few hundred thousand people in New York City getting together and marching around and playing hacky sack and carrying cheese sandwiches in their back pockets with a lot of signs. We can't cover that. I mean, there was a Syrian refugee crisis going on, and people were running from ISIS or ISIL or IS or whatever it is we're calling it these days. And there was a brand new power sharing agreement in Afghanistan. No, really. That was their excuses for not offering broader coverage of the People's Climate March. And then there were the people who pointed out that it really has turned into National Petroleum Radio, and Mr. Schumacher Matos didn't like that in the least. Some of the critics pointed to NPR's acceptance of short sponsorship ads from corporations, and especially America's Natural Gas Alliance, as proof. You know, proof that the extractive industries are kind of running the show now over at NPR. Well, of course, people are just wrong. And Mr. Schumacher Matos, well, corporate and other business sponsorships account for 25% of NPR's revenues, but in my more than 3 years as ombudsman, I have yet to find a single incident in which a story was influenced by a sponsor or by a fear of losing or offending one. You either believe that or you don't. I don't. Because I'm not in the believing business, Ed. Jumping Jehoshaphat. Yes, NPR must avoid the appearance of conflicts of interest, but where do you draw the line? Should it not accept money from the government? From foundations? From private individuals? Should it just fold up its tent and disappear? No, you shouldn't take money from people who are trying to wipe out the ability of human beings to live on the planet, Ed. Mm. as EcoWatch notes, he went on to say, you either trust that there's this unbridgeable wall and ethic, or you don't. Simply to point to sponsors as proof that NPR skews its coverage is not proof at all. It is cynicism. It's not unlike the claims made by the far right about NPR. No, it's not at all like the claims of the far right about NPR, because the far right claims that NPR is a communist, socialist tool of the Kenyan Muslim, you slurper anti-colonialist in our White House. And that's not what people are saying. They're saying that, in fact, when your sponsorships say, brought to you by the American Natural Gas Alliance, and then suddenly there are no stories about toxins coming from fracking water anymore, that maybe there's a connection there. Jeebus. So that's our first that's our first thorn in the side. But like I said, there is a larger a parallel inquiry to be made. And that is the question of what constitutes environmental reporting. There's another parallel question as to whether we should even refer to it as environmental reporting. And I know I probably annoy some people when I say this, but I really am at a place where I kind of reject it. Because for so very long, environmentalism was this little niche, white privilege kind of topic that really didn't have It didn't have any resonance with people who were struggling just to pay the bills every month and live difficult lives under the circumstances that people live them, whether it be here in the United States or families who live in a goddamn coal pit somewhere in India. I mean, in the coal mine they live. And to say that a story about, I remember when we covered this, a story about indigenous peoples being displaced by a proposed strip mine in where? Burma? No, Bangladesh. To say that people who've been on the land for 20,000 years being displaced is an environmental story instead of filing it under human rights? What? But I do understand. I do understand that people want this stuff covered. God knows if there had been more coverage of mountaintop removal when it was getting started, maybe it wouldn't be the toxic, death-dealing nightmare that it is today. Or then there's the very cynical ploy engaged in by the natural gas industry when they passed around some several tens of millions of dollars to the Sierra Club and the Natural Resources Defense Council. And ultimately, when these organizations got caught, they had to give the money back. But it had bought the frackers precious time to get going. And once it gets going, it is almost impossible to stop. And that's the kind of thing that NPR is contributing to when they take this money. If it's wrong for the Sierra Club to take tens of millions of dollars from a fracking company, it ought to be wrong for NPR to take it too. Because it does create the appearance of impropriety. And we also need to find a better language for referring to these assaults on people's ability to live their lives on the little, whatever little corner of the planet they happen to be on. I need to do a better job. NPR needs to do a better job. A lot of us need to do a better job. Case in point, I just opened a tab here, and I have had this thing laying around since August. And I'm ashamed of myself over this. On any given night when we talk about some of the sillier stuff we talk about here, I could have been talking about this. We could have been discussing this. We could have been considering this. Michael in the chat room says, Bob, notice how most of the big green activist organizations aren't talking about the meat industry? Seems like that would be a primary concern. Oh, there's lots of stuff they don't talk about. Save the last gray wolf. Sorry, White Fang. Save the last dolphin. Flipper. No, this story goes back to August, and it has got an absolutely kind of headline to it. Physicists say Fukushima reactors pose eternal threat to humanity. What? Because it's not very often you hear physicists use the word eternal. The dateline is Moscow. This comes from a website called Global Research. Take it for what you will, but the facts in here seem fairly convincing. Dateline Moscow. The three molten cores at Fukushima plant, each weighing 100 tons, are so radioactive that no one can approach them, including robots, which melt down immediately. This information was delivered by Dr. Helen Caldicott. And no one ever will, she says, and the contamination will go on for hundreds of years. The report goes on, the piece goes on to say, TEPCO, the Japanese power provider, wanted to erect an ice wall. Oh, that'll work nicely. An ice wall? Really? Around the perimeter of the Fukushima complex as groundwater underneath the reactor is absorbing radiation and then flowing into the ocean. In a moment of profound understatement, the author of this piece says, an ice wall is a silly idea, given the circumstances. God, this reminds me of that Australian crew. The front fell off. We're going to put an ice wall around it. That'll fix it. An ice wall is a silly idea, given the circumstances, as it would have to last at least 100 years. Moreover, you would have to have electricity running all the time to keep the ground frozen. That, according to Helen Caldicott again. And this is apparently translated from the original Russian, so that probably accounts for why the English is a bit stilted. The expert stresses they are witnessing an absolute catastrophe. 300 to 400 tons of radioactive water pour daily into the Pacific, and this has been going on for over 3 years now, contaminating the ocean and its ecology. God damn, not quite to 6:30 p.m. here in the Eastern time zone. We're already at the swirly straw and fruit jar stage. Radiation cannot be diluted, the report goes on. Strontium gets concentrated in food chains, like in algae, which then go on up via the consumption cycle. Thomas Drolet, chairman, CEO, and president at Greenwell Renewable Power Corporation, says that as a technician and nuclear reactor engineer, I can say that they will eventually succeed. Okay, good for you. But even he acknowledges there remain problems at Fukushima. mainly the water and the groundwater and the stuff that continues to flow out into the Pacific. Each of the three damaged reactors has two main areas of broken fuel in the spent fuel base, which is up high, and the reactor core, you know, core on the floor. Slowly and identically, they have to remove that fuel, some of it damaged, some of it whole, using the robotic equipment to a great extent, and move it off-site to the repository. The only problem being, loop back to the beginning, the robots melt. The front falls off. At least we got the we finally got the story back. It got it in. Jeremy with a question. Wait just a minute. Hundreds of years? That'd be nice. It's more like 250,000 years. Eesh. Darlene with a note regarding NPR. One way I will respond to NPR, I will continue to not contribute to NPR. Sorry for the bad grammar, Bob. Didn't hurt one bit, because I would continue to not contribute, too. Thank you very kindly to Luda for kicking in. And thank you to Reinhard. We have crossed the boundary. We are up. We are up over. We just filled in the. We filled in the hole. Thank you, one and all. If you're still in a helping mood, we could take care of tomorrow too, which would be grand. Thank you. Thank you very much, Reinhard, and thank you, Luda, and thank you, Sparky, for getting it started with the Pull the Pin Challenge, and thank you, Roger. Thank you very, very much. So you get it, and oh, by the way, since we went to Fukushima, let's come back around and consider a little something dealing with other radioactive stuff, toxic stuff, and we can ask the question: is this an environmental story, or is this a foreign policy story, or is this a war story? Maybe it's all of the above. But the story means different things to different people. Over at Truth Out, a story by David Swanson. U.S. sends planes armed with depleted uranium to Middle East. Well, of course we did. We love us some depleted uranium, even though the rest of the world seems to have figured out that it's a really right there on the very thin, fine line between war crimes and not a war crime. Probably more over toward the war crime side when you get right down to it. According to Al Jazeera and David Swanson, the Air National Guard's 122nd Fighter Wing has been deployed to the Middle East now, and that is a bunch of A-10s. Isn't the A-10 the one they call the warthog? Kind of an ugly, slow-moving thing that packs a hell of a wallop. Well, the wallop these A-10s will be packing is depleted uranium. Yeah, that depleted uranium. The A-10 is apparently over the American involvement in the Middle East over the last couple of decades. The A-10 is more responsible than any other weapons platform for delivery of depleted uranium weapons than any other weapons platform. Yeah, it's a the A-10 is a tank killer plane, but as Paul notes, it also works great on farmers and children. According to the International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons, weight for weight and by number of rounds, more 30mm PGU-14B ammo has been used than any other round. and that's the ammo used by A-10s. Master Sergeant Darren L. Hubble of the 122nd Fighter Wing confirmed that the A-10s are in the Middle East along with 300 of our finest airmen. Their deployment has been planned for the past 2 years. They haven't been assigned to take part in the current fighting in Iraq or Syria, but as Master Sergeant Hubble says, that could change at any moment. We have, of course, toxified the land between the rivers, Mesopotamia. We have toxified it with depleted uranium. The number of children being born with horrendous birth defects there is shocking to the conscience. And you know what? It's not because they're Muslims. And it's not because Saddam was a brutal dictator who killed his own people. He tried to kill my daddy. We took him out. God told me to. Not because of that either. It's because the United States military has been salting the earth with depleted uranium since the early 1990s. Have signed on to a resolution regarding banning depleted uranium. 155 nations. Who said no? Of course, the United States said no. So did France. So did the UK. And the fourth member of that little quadrupoly? Israel. Because, you know, Israel might need... Oh, there, absolutely. Never know when you're going to have to use depleted uranium on them goddamn Gazans. Right? Interviewed by Mr. Swanson, Congressman Jim McDermott of Washington said, I fear depleted uranium is this generation's Agent Orange. There has been a sizable increase in childhood leukemia and birth defects in Iraq since the Gulf War and our subsequent invasion in 2003. DU munitions were used in both of those conflicts. There are also grave suggestions that DU weapons have caused serious health issues for our Iraq War veterans. I seriously question the use of these weapons until the U.S. military conducts a full investigation into the effect of DU weapon residue on human beings. Ultrafines again. You know, they go down the rifled barrel of whatever thing, and, you know, some of the stuff comes off the shell and gets aerosolized. And, yeah, you breathe it at the breech of the artillery piece, or you breathe it if you're near where it hits. Ron and Raleigh with a note. Hey, Bob, you can't store that shit in a shed out back. You might as well take it somewhere we aren't. They keep trying to retire the warthog, but they can't find a replacement. It's so good at what it does. Good, of course. Being... shall we say a relative term? Good at what it does in terms of, you know, good at turning human beings into their constituent molecular parts. Even human beings who weren't involved in the fighting. Even human beings who are, you know, busy being fully formed inside their mother's wombs and come out not so fully formed. It by the way, DU, according to David Swanson, is classed as a Group 1 carcinogen, according to the World Health Organization. Gina Shaw is from the Center for Constitutional Rights, said that contamination also enters the soil and the water. Contaminated scrap metals used in factories are made into cooking pots or played with by children. Because, of course, Iraq is a place where children play with scrap metal instead of toys because of what we did. Yeah. Gina Shaw said the U.S. has denied a relationship between depleted uranium and health problems in civilians and veterans. Studies of UK veterans are highly suggestive of a connection. The U.S. doesn't want studies done. And among other things, if one started pointing out that depleted uranium was used by the United States in civilian areas, it could raise some charges of, violations of the Geneva Conventions and various... See what I mean about environmental stories being human rights stories? And David Swanson closes his article at Truth Out by noting, meanwhile, the Obama administration said on Thursday that it will be spending $1.6 million to try to identify atrocities committed in Iraq by ISIS. Your tax dollars at work. It's... Definitely thorn in the side Thursday. And, I'm kind of two minds about whether to talk about this Chris Christie business and the Paul LePage business in Maine. Because I think we all understand that those are two just nasty, odious exemplars of attempted membership in the human race. But the bullying video, and that's the thing. Chris Christie's a bully. Plain and simple. And the way, the intemperate way in which he blessed out, as we say around here, a guy simply asking him with a sign at a public appearance, because the guy, it's not like he could get a meeting with the governor. It's not like the governor's staff would meet with him. So he showed up asking the governor to please stay home in New Jersey and attend to people who still desperately need relief from Hurricane Sandy. And Chris Christie responded by calling him everything but a human being. Okay, I mean, there was no vulgarity involved, but... Oh, go find the video. It's easy. The political sites all have it. Also, when it was mentioned to him that Casey Hickox might be suing... He responded by saying, "Whatever, get in line." And I guess somebody has told Chris Christie that this plays well with the voters because they see him as being, you know, tough. When all it is bullying, it would be completely, utterly, totally recognizable on an elementary school playground. But if you're a Republican, It means that you're a no bullshit leadership type. So Casey Hickox decamped from her, you know, I'm going to call it what it was, her kidnapping. She was kidnapped by the state of New Jersey and headed, and when she got free, she headed home to Maine, where, of course, they have a sort of Chris Christie wannabe in the form of a guy named Paul LePage, who's a dick. Jerk. Let's desexualize these things. He's a jerk. And he has, you know, he's canceled trips that he had scheduled because he's going to stay right there in Augusta and keep an eye on Casey Hickox. I mean, this is some of the shittiest, most tawdry conduct I've seen in a while. And we see a lot. She said, no, by God, she was asymptomatic. She's not, she doesn't have Ebola, egads. And so she was going to go on living her life. And today she went out for a bike ride with her boyfriend. You might recall a couple of days ago when I was talking with Carol, she mentioned the fact that she had described her significant other as her partner, and all the little right-wing morons said, see, that means she's a lesbian. That's one of them words lesbians use for their other lesbian. Partners. No, sorry. They went out for a bike ride. The state police followed her. And now, just got a note from Carol, after the bike ride, Paul LePage has declared that he's going to have her nursing license revoked. For what? Negligent cycling? Cycling while not having Ebola? Remember, these Christie, LePage, that jackass in Michigan, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, these are the textbook exemplars of the people that we're being told the voters of the United States are going to empower in the Congress even further. Oh my God, Carol tells me that Casey Hickox was actually, she was wearing a bicycling helmet. God damn, that just proves she's got the Ebola. It's moments like this, and moments like the shooting of Michael Brown, that test the question of whether civil rights in the United States of America have any meaning whatsoever anymore. Yeah, good point. Asa in Vancouver pointing out what was even more sickening than Governor Crisco's vulgarity was seeing the goons in the crowd cheering him it on. Yeah, because they cheered when he said, yeah, sit down, shut up, go away, I'm baiting. In order to quarantine Casey Hickox, if I understand correctly, a two-part test would have to be met. And it sounds to me like it's similar to the test for a commitment for someone alleged to be mentally ill. Now, at least in the state of West Virginia, the way I was taught when I had that cup of coffee up at Harvard on the Mon, if you think somebody is dangerously mentally ill, you have to prove first that they have a mental illness or that they are addicted to drugs or alcohol. If the answer to that question is yes, Then you have to say, then you have to answer the question, is this person a threat to himself or others? And then if the answer is yes, you can take action to take them into some form of custody, mental health custody. Well, it kind of has to work that way, I think, in the case of quarantining of diseased people. Question one, does she have the Ebola? If the answer is no, game over. Go home. Go ride your bicycle. Go to the grocery store. Do any goddamn thing you want to do, as long as it's within the legal parameters of what an American citizen fully vested with his or her civil rights can do. 1 wonders if she is going to vote on Tuesday. 1 wonders if Paul LePage will have his goons there to try to prevent that. Yeah, but it's Ebola! Precisely. When's the last time you heard of a quarantine over the flu? Over chicken pox? Right. You don't. Now, I remember when right-wingers wanted to quarantine people and send them off to camps over HIV. They were wrong about that, too. But time after time after time after time on this program, I have pointed out that the Bill of Rights has, and particularly the First Amendment, has become little more than a life support system for the religion industry. But there are lots of rights in the Bill of Rights, such as, well, obviously, free speech. But it's not just free speech. It is the right not to have the government suppress your speech or tell you what religion you must be a member of, or to tell you that you can't complain to the government about things that grieve you, or that you can't freely assemble peaceably. Then, of course, there's the other life support system, and that is the Second Amendment, the holy and sacred Second Amendment. And maybe if Casey Hickox was carrying a gun, then she'd be a danger, and the Second Amendment would go out the window. Then there's little old Amendment Number 4, because we're going to blow past should we? Paul LePage has camped the state police out on her property. Amendment 3 to the Constitution of the United States says no soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law. Does that mean that Casey Hickox can object to having the state police on her lawn? No. But Amendment 4. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Person to be seized. Not according to Paul LePage. Described by Charlie Pierce over at Esquire.com as human bowling jacket Paul LePage. But if you wanted to seize, arrest Casey Hickox, it seems that the Fourth Amendment is saying that there would have to be some showing of probable cause. And there would have to be some sort of oath or affirmation. What would the oath look like? I do hereby solemnly swear that Casey Hickox has done been to the country of Africa and has been around some countries where they got the Ebola. And she won't stay put, even though she ain't got no symptoms of Ebola. In the final analysis, this is a case of course, political cowardice. Because the one thing that a Republican politician cannot stand is to be seen as somehow weak. And instead of having to ask to explain to terrified, hysterical, right-wing microbrains why it is you can't just throw people in prison and throw away the key, it's easier just to pander to them. So that's Amendment 4. How about number 5? No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases, okay, so that's not, it doesn't even matter, nothing there. Except for the fact that it says public danger. But that doesn't apply. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury. Well, she hasn't committed an infamous crime or a capital crime, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger. That's where we get the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property. This is where this part matters. Nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. See, what goons like Christie and LePage are doing is in no wise even remotely related to the concept of due process of law. This is trial by fiat, imprisonment by fiat, quarantine by whim. Then there's Amendment 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. May we argue that to punish someone in the form of quarantine, for whom there is no evidence whatsoever of having been even remotely connected with the disease in question, is cruel and is, to say the least, unusual? Yeah. If you take a long enough look at the conduct of people like Chris Christie and Paul LePage, you can see the future. You can see an autocratic, authoritarian United States from your house. B. Because that is what we are talking about here. We are talking about governors who are trying to rule by declaration. And no, this is not the same as what the right wingers talk about. That Barack Obama, him and them executive orders, the Constitution is dying. No, it isn't. But the Constitution is threatened when nasty martinets like Christie and LePage think that they can take it into their own hands by their own say-so and start depriving people of what's life, liberty, and property. Yeah. So, it's a minute past the hour. Let's take a break. You, if you wish, are more than welcome to light up the phones. You know the number, the Skype line, 304-574-8178, 304-574-8178, or the Gizmo line, 304-663-HORN, H-O-R-N. 304-663-4676. Skype to Skype, which works just dandy, as we find, as you can hear on most evenings. Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. If you've never sent me a contact request and you want to do that, I will approve it straight away. Thank you, Marty. Marty says, because my San Francisco Giants won the World Series last night, I make a contribution. And then my Wi-Fi connection drops. Thank you, Marty. Thank you very kindly. So we are $125 away now, $120 away, from finishing up with tomorrow night's fundraising. Thank you all very, very much. So light them up, the phone lines, that is. Email if you prefer that. Twitter if you prefer that. At Bob Kincaid is the Twitter address. And Bob Kincaid on Facebook. Okie doke. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
I was halfway crucified. I was on the other side of no tomorrow.
All right, I wish I had any idea whatsoever what the hell's going on there. No freaking clue. I do hate audio that just starts running. There went our break, I guess. Just kind of looking forward to it. Where could that possibly be? That's just weird. Now I'm absolutely, someday we'll have a staff.
We help make.
Now I'll be dipped. there you are. All better now. Yeah. So maybe we can take a break after all. Okay, one more time.
It's Thursday, October 30, 2014.
Sit down and shut up.
Superstorm Sandy recovery stalled 2 years later.
Oh, it's a teeny, itsy-bitsy greenhouse gas, but it's not in any way significant.
The Weather Channel repudiates its climate-denying co-founder. Plus, the latest UN climate science report has an important message for you.
It is not hopeless.
All of that hopelessness and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment. This week, sponsored by Koch Industries.
We're Koch Industries, not just an energy company. We're in your food, in your pants, and in your home. With our heartfelt devotion to fossil fuels, we make your planet warmer and your water more flammable while lubricating your birds and rearranging your polar bears. We're Koch Industries, the next generation of robber barons, bending the democratic process to our will since 1980.
This is your Green News Report, and we approve of this message. Okay, Desi Doyen, aside from elections, this week also marks the 2-year anniversary since the largest hurricane ever on record hit the U.S., Hurricane Sandy, 2 years ago, just days before the 2012 election. New Jersey's Republican Governor Chris Christie earned great praise for his handling of the crisis. How elegantly is he handling it now?
Not so good. This week does mark 2 years since Superstorm Sandy and its record storm surge devastated parts of New Jersey and New York City, killing 70 people, causing $70 billion in damages, and exposing just how much the U.S. is not ready for extreme weather events in an era of accelerating climate change. Republicans in Congress blocked federal disaster relief funds for Hurricane Sandy victims for 3 months, and now, 2 years later, New Jersey's Governor Chris Christie has an answer for irate displaced homeowners who want to know why the state is still sitting on an estimated $800 million in federal disaster recovery funds.
You want to have the conversation later? I'm happy to have it, buddy. But until that time, sit down and shut up.
That was Governor Christie's amazing response to a Hurricane Sandy victim who wanted to know, where are those hundreds of millions of dollars that were supposed to be given to victims to help them move back into their house? Christie didn't want to talk about it for some reason.
No, he didn't. New York State and New York City, however, have launched billion-dollar resiliency plans to harden their infrastructure, but New Jersey is doing little to adapt, allowing homeowners and businesses to pretty much rebuild in the same places they were before. Meanwhile, the Weather Channel has repudiated the views of its co-founder, retired meteorologist and denier John Coleman, who went on Fox News this week to claim that global warming is a hoax, and science deniers like himself are a downtrodden minority.
You know, a climate skeptic can rarely get on TV. The media has told the nation over and over again, day after day, for 20 years, that the oceans are rising, the polar bears are dying, the sea, the ice is melting, that storms are going to sweep the earth, and that we're all going to die of a heat wave. I mean, this is an incredible bad, bad science.
Bad, bad science, eh? That, of course, was the co-founder of the Weather Channel, who right-wing denialists can't get enough of quoting.
And the Weather Channel politely responded with its first-ever official position statement, solidly endorsing the global scientific consensus that global warming is real, it's dangerous, and it's man-made. Key sentence, quote, "The potential exists for the climate to reach a tipping point, if it hasn't already done so, and beyond which radical and irreversible changes occur."
So they threw their Looney Tune right-wing denier co-founder under the proverbial weather bus.
Yep. And at the UN...
It is not hopeless. This is not to say it will be easy. It won't. A great deal of work and tall hurdles lie ahead, but it can be done.
That's the message from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in its final Climate Science Synthesis Report and Summary for Policymakers. It's unfortunate timing that the IPCC's report comes out just 2 days before the U.S. midterm election. The report warns in stark terms we are near to triggering, quote, irreversible climate impacts from the burning of fossil fuels. But there is hope in action, according to IPCC Chairman Rajendra Pachauri.
We still have time to build a better, more sustainable world. We still have time to avoid the most serious impacts of climate change. But we have precious little of that time.
Well, that's fine, Desi Doyen, but I've got a message for you, for the UN, and Rajendra Prachari.
Sit down and shut up.
For much more of that message, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help the Green News Report stay on the air, at least until the Weather Channel decides to give us our own show. Pretty please? Find us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Bad, bad science.
Shut up! I know about your kind. You're like the independent network news on Channel 9. You talk too much.
You never shut up.
I said you talk too much.
Homeboy, you never
shut up.
I don't know. I'm thinking some enterprising mixologist might take that bad, bad science and work it in with some Thomas Dolby and have a nice little mashup to work with, or maybe just create an entirely new piece. Either way, just things that run through my mind. It is about 16 minutes past the hour on this, the 30th day of October 2014. Note coming in from Steve in China. Bob, if you're talking nuclear madness, death by dying nuke power plants, eternal contamination, etc., you can't beat knowing just two little letters. G-E. GE, the We Bring Good Things to Life people, is perhaps the most stealth-effective mega-conglomerate entity in the history of capitalist, commercial, anything. They function pretty much as a de facto arm of the American defense industry, make their big money on every aspect of the processing, transport, storage, disposal of fresh and spent fuel, design the nuclear facilities themselves, and of course create the regulations under which they operate, in addition to advertising their efforts as a sort of family-friendly, world-of-the-future fantasy about unlimited power and happy, happy lifestyles. Aw, gosh, Steve says, it's enough to make you weep for those wonderful post-war visions of nuclear-powered Oldsmobiles in every driveway and dear old Dad bouncing off to another day of fun and frolic at the Atom Smashing Factory. You can go to GE-energy.com, look for anything under products and services, nuclear energy. It's real. It's this century. They actually want you to know more about the new fleet of nuclear generators they're designing. You know, like the ones they built for the U.S. Navy submarine fleet. Any light bulbs lighting up yet? Like a freaking Christmas tree, Steve. Thanks. And this coming in from Tim. Subject line, science and logic. After a great discussion with Lottie last night on Skype chat and his knowledge of biosafety levels, it was refreshing to hear a scientist speak the truth, for once. Of course, Ebola is biosafety level 4, the highest, and doctors must wear a spacesuit. The chance of someone infecting someone on the verge of dying of Ebola in public is minimal, unless the blood or feces comes in contact with the person. Walking down the street and passing someone with Ebola, possibly with blood coming out of their orifice, is very minimal, so long as you don't come in contact with the blood or the waste product. I find it sickening, Kemp says, that the Repuclicans are making a big stink about hemorrhagic fever, but more people die from influenza, and that virus can be caught easier. Where's the protest? Where's the panic? You know, after Tuesday's election, watch the Ebola stories fade, or if they continue, when flu season hits, watch the Repuclicans and teabaggers start screaming, Ebola epidemic! And hospitals are taxed heavily. I know it's a thorn in the side today, but shouldn't Jesus protect them good Christians? Yeah, that's why they don't panic about the flu. Because John Calvin done told them a few hundred years ago that if they don't get the flu, it means God likes them. Or if they get rich, God likes them. Or if they win the lottery, it's because God likes them. And if you don't, it's because he doesn't. But to back up there in something Tim mentioned in his note, let's do remember that the people who lived with Thomas Duncan while he was in the full throes of Ebola didn't get Ebola. And it's not because they have some sort of special anti-colonialist Kenyan immunity. It's because it's kind of hard to get. and it spread. It has spread the way it has in the West African countries of Sierra Leone and Guinea and Liberia because of cultural traditions that require the handling, rather intimate handling, of corpses. We don't do that here. But this, like everything else, I mean, look, the Ebola terror is no more real than the war on coal. It's no more real than Benghazi. It's no more real than IRS gate. It's no more real than the tan suit crisis. There are real crises in this country, but none of those are one of them. Or any of those. None of, whatever, grammar. You want to talk about a crisis in this country? We have an infrastructure crisis. We have an education crisis. We have a constitutional crisis insofar as we have a Congress that will not allow the twice-elected president of the United States to go about the business of being president. We have an employment crisis. I remember we talked about that a few weeks ago. All you ever hear is that unemployment's fallen to whatever number. But that's just for the recently unemployed. For people who haven't had a job in more than a year, and certain demographic segments of this country, unemployment is at epidemic proportions. Try getting the for-profit media to take note of that. Everybody will go to sleep. Crisis. But Tuesday really is election day. And Jesus Christ, one voter suppression story after another coming out of right-wing dominated states. The governor of New Mexico, Susana Martinez, tries to masquerade as some sort of moderate. There is no such thing. According to Progress Now New Mexico, the New Mexico Motor Vehicles Division, oh, this is disgusting on so many levels. New Mexico Motor Vehicles Division has circulated a memo to its employees regarding the issuance of photo IDs that will pass muster for voting purposes. You can find this at Progress Now NM. Progress Now NM. WordPress.com. MVD policy on illiterates and Navajo-only speakers generates outcry. Because that's what this is about. When the story was initially reported, the memo said agents are not allowed to read the questions on driver's license applications to a customer. They would need a letter stating they have a condition that falls under the Americans with Disabilities Act for us to read the questions. Applicants should be able to read the questions on their own since it raises questions as to how they obtained their driver's license. We are not able to issue license for illiterates. Motor Vehicles Department staff were made to sign copies of the email to show that they understood the policy change. Mm-hmm. And it was initial, and they were told they could only fill out basic information on the application like their name and address for people who were native speakers of Navajo, the Navajo language. You know, spoken on this continent for 10,000 years. Or roughly 9,500 years before Spanish was ever heard. 9,400 before English. Not kidding. But now the firestorm of controversy has been created. The New Mexico Motor Vehicle Division has clarified what it meant. They said the email was poorly worded. Goddess of irony. It just kind of, you know, cracked one little eyelid open. She never sleeps. Just went and waved a finger at New Mexico. And suddenly, yeah, a document pertaining to literacy was poorly worded. In other words, the people who were concerned with the art of knowing words were not very good at the art of knowing words. Jesus. We are not able to issue license for illiterates. Meanwhile, there were also no applications in Navajo. Isn't that charming? Yeah, Tim, you're right. We have an epidemic of stupidity. Let's go to the Skype line. Grant is with us. Hey, Grant.
Hey, Bob.
How are you?
I'm doing good. Can you hear me all right?
I hear you dandy.
All right. Well, you know, a buddy of mine turned me on to an article, and I just really wanted to bring it to everybody's attention.
Yes.
I pasted a link in the chat a little earlier, but if people not in the chat want to, go to Google and Google Putin, play time is over. The speech he gave at Sochi is featured prominently. Club Orlov is the blog. And this is a, you know, although it made not a ripple in Western media, this is probably one of the most key speeches that he's ever given. And he really does take to task a lot of the meddling of the West in that speech. But I think also he does a good job of putting to rest some of the criticisms that have been levied against him by our media. It makes it very clear that Russia is not interested in reestablishing an empire, that it's self-sufficient, nor does it want to go begging, you know, or be forced into a situation like that.
Right.
And in every way, I think basically he was saying respect our interests, or at least factor them into your calculations. Don't just simply bowl over the top of us as if we don't exist. And I think that's fair. I think that's very fair. But you look at the exceptionalism that is sort of standard operating procedure within our State Department, and, you know, it's no mystery whatsoever as to how we got to where we're at.
And this speech, I'm looking at the link you sent me, this speech was only given a few days ago, right?
Yeah, the 29th, actually. At least it was published on the 29th.
And the writer says it's probably the most important political speech since Churchill's Iron Curtain speech of March 5th, 1946.
Exactly. Hear about it yet in the media? Fuck no.
Of course not. Of course not.
The Ministry of Truth would not allow such a thing to peep through the cracks. And yet here we are.
Point six, Russia will not attempt to reformat the world in her own image, but neither will she allow anyone to reformat her in their image. Russia will not close herself off from the world, but anyone who tries to close her off from the world will be sure to reap a whirlwind. Hmm. Sure. surely to goodness, the White House has been briefed on this.
Oh, you're right. I would think.
I like paragraph 5 myself. Russia has no intention of going fishing in the murky waters created by America's ever-expanding empire of chaos. And has no interest in building a new empire of her own. This is unnecessary. Russia's challenges lie in developing her already vast territory. Neither is Russia willing to act as a savior of the world as she had in the past. Ooh, now, there's one right across the bow.
Yep.
I thought America saved the world in World War II and World War I. It's America.
Right. It's like Idiocracy. I took a ride on the time machine. We defeated Hitler and the dinosaurs.
Hey, get your hands off my junk.
That's right.
Baiting. Oh, God, America's baiting.
Pretty much. I mean, it really looks...
No, like this is fascinating. I had a chance to... I had a chance to browse this shortly before airtime.
Yeah, sorry to spring it on you before the show. I wish I could have given you more lead time on it.
Well, it's a long post.
Yeah, I read the whole thing and the comments.
Oh, you went into the comments?
Yeah, they're actually pretty good. No cornholers in there. Just straight up, you know, people from the UK, people from Germany, you know, nice sampling.
What is Club Orlov?
I don't know. It's some blog. In Finland is the one I got.
Okay. Well, that it's absolutely fascinating. It's going to be hard not to take that empire of chaos and not put it into daily use.
I know. Well, it fits so well, doesn't it? Lace that bitch up.
It's accurate.
Yes, he nailed it. So that's what I'm saying. I mean, he really nailed a lot of our problem in that speech. You know, and he's just looking from the outside.
And you know, it's true. He does. Now, to be fair, and I don't want to draw unfair historical parallels, Grant.
Uh-huh.
But another individual once said, "We have no designs on anyone else's territory." And we seek only Lebensraum.
Yes, for the hangman.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the perplexing things about Putin is you can never quite get it out of the back of your mind that this guy is an old KGB spook.
Yeah.
And so misdirection and disinformation are his stock in trade.
True. True enough.
And so it requires the supposedly smart people to sit there and figure out, you know, what does he really mean?
Right.
Now, if I was to take a run at that, I would interpret what I read there of those points as they were laid out as Russia is going to sit back, watch us F ourselves righteously.
With a cactus.
Exactly. And then come in and pick up the pieces.
I get that too.
And that way you don't have to try to be an empire. You just wind up one morning.
Well, you're the last man standing, aren't you?
But see, I thought that was us. How many times have the for-profit media told us we're the last superpower, the only superpower?
Right.
I think if you want to be the last superpower, you kind of need to be the last one with any nuclear weapons, don't you?
Just about.
And yet, unless I'm mistaken, there's a whole bunch of nations with, I don't sit around worrying about, you know, EBOLA.
Mm-hmm.
But I do sit around worrying about PAKISTAN and NORTHKOREA.
Yeah, yeah.
And ISRAEL. Mm-hmm. You know, three paranoid states with lots of nuclear weapons.
Yeah, they're troublesome and worrisome. Yes, I agree.
So, I mean, yeah.
I did really like his comments, though. I think, I agree with you. He's an ex-KGB spook. But for bullshit, that's mighty, mighty sterling bullshit, if it is. And I think he's taken to task our establishment quite well. Because, I mean, it's just been one fuck-up with a cactus after the next.
Foreign policy is one of those places where you can be an equal opportunity critic, Grant.
I suppose.
We have never, I mean never, in the history of this nation as presently constituted, we have never been worth a tinker's damn at foreign policy. No good at it at all. From the XYZ affair to the what's-their-names affairs during the Civil War, to the fact that the general of our armies at the turn of the 18th into the 19th century, the guy who was running the entire United States military structure west of the Mississippi, was a paid agent of the Spanish crown. And we didn't know. And when Thomas Jefferson got told, it was like, what? He was more interested in trying to hound Aaron Burr to death. When this guy had actually been in on the Burr business. His name was Wilkinson, by the way.
Now, Burr, he wanted to establish an empire in the West, right?
Well, that was what was put on him.
Okay.
But he also said he wanted to take a bunch of farmers out west of the, north of the, what river? Ouachita.
Uh-huh.
And just start farming. And that's what, it's one of the more fascinating parts of American history because nobody really knows the answer. He was more enigmatic than just about any other member of that founding group, and yet he survived just about the longest.
Ironic.
By the time that they both died on July the 4th, 1826, Jefferson and Adams had seen, and anybody who says otherwise just doesn't know what's going on, they had seen their revolutionary dreams collapse. Even Madison admits that the constitutional structure they set up was not what was had morphed into something that was not what they had in mind, and that's why Dr. Bill spent all that time talking about that passage where the framers say, you know, this might last 100 years, but we're probably going to wind up with a monarch.
Right.
And that was just because that was the only model they had to work with. They never dreamed that there could be an empire that was run by a rotating administrator. Because, among other things, they had not put anything, you know, they didn't put a term limit on the presidency. They figured the presidency, awful job that it is, would be term limited up.
Right, they didn't foresee the FDRs.
Well, and they didn't see the crisis that would necessitate that. But I would say that most presidents ending their second term, are more than ready to quit.
They always look old. You notice that?
Oh, well, Democratic presidents do. Democratic presidents get ancient in office, be it 4 years or eight. Republican presidents get all Dorian Gray and seem to get younger. I mean, Reagan's brain was Swiss cheesed by Alzheimer by the time he was out of office, but he looked younger than when he went in.
Hell of a party, I guess.
I think it comes from not giving a damn about most of the people in the country.
True.
I mean, is anybody going to sit there and try to convince me that George W. Bush actually gave a good goddamn about a minimum wage worker in Busted Knuckle, Wyoming, or Busted Knuckle anywhere in America? Hell no! Of course he didn't!
You know, I think the Katrina incident really demonstrated the deep caring that he had for the people of the country. if something happens, you're on your own, baby.
Yeah.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, after all, right?
Yeah, and then cried like a baby when Kanye West said George Bush don't like black people.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't. And it's not so much that he actively dislikes black folks, it's that he just doesn't bother to think about them any more than he thinks about poor white folks. They don't exist. They are less than the frogs that he used to stuff M-80s up their butts and blow up when he was a sociopathic child.
There's an image.
It is that, isn't it? You doing okay otherwise, Grant?
Mm-hmm. One thing, though, it's interesting about our foreign policy now. The way I see it, they go after, they're making this a business where they churn up, I mean, I'm convinced of it, they go in and deliberately churn up turmoil, terrorism, and all these things just so they can get hired to go fight it. I'm convinced of it. This has become like shock doctrine, terror as profit center, basically.
Well, yeah.
And it's working its way into the economics to solidify into a permanent war for permanent profits. That's what I'm seeing.
That's only because that's what it is. You know, what Steve in China said about GE is very true. War is good business. You know, we famously maintained our neutrality for a while Europe butchered itself in the First World War 100 years ago. Later on Calvin Coolidge would say, the business of America is business.
Yeah.
American business wasn't neutral. We were selling for all we were worth. And it happened again before we entered the Second World War. IBM, Ford, Brown Brothers, Harriman, up to their knuckles in Nazi Germany because they looked, this time through, they looked like the horse to back.
Yep.
But there is a very, there's a very memorable scene in the movie Reds. Have you ever seen it?
Yeah, I think I did some time ago. It's in the 80s, I think, right?
Yeah, it's worth a rewatch. It has stood the test of time. And there's a scene where Jack Reed, at a dinner party in Portland, stands up to give his opinion of the First World War and says, well, I think we're eventually going to get into this war because American capital has sunk itself up to its neck in investing in this war, and if we let Britain and France lose, American capital will never get paid back, so we're going to have to send some sons over there to get butchered to make sure our wealth class is okay. I'm paraphrasing, but pretty close, really.
I think that nailed it.
And, you know, I know the right wing didn't like to admit it, but how in the hell was anything going on in the early Gulf War? I call it Bush War One. I call it Bush War One and Bush War Two. Mm-hmm. How was any of that not? The right wing didn't like it, but how was any of that, Grant, not war for oil?
Correct. Right. It was always about the oil.
I am generally speaking, I am anti-war. But, and I say that so as not to be misapprehended here.
Yes.
But when's the last time we went to war somewhere that we didn't have big corporate interests?
Grenada?
Okay, yeah.
You know, we had to liberate the engineering students or some shit, I think.
Medical students, weren't they? Or...
Medical students, okay.
But that was, you know, that was because Reagan was bored out of his mind, literally. And then we did Panama because Manuel Noriega had broken the code of Omerta with La Familia Bush.
Yeah.
So he had to be taken out.
We can't have Pineapple Face talking about the cocaine runs.
No. Vietnam? No, that was... I don't care how many dominoes they talked about falling. That turned out to be economics. I think you could argue that Korea maybe wasn't... So you jump past that, and then you go back to Smedley Butler, and he will give you chapter and verse of every place that he was posted as he said, making the world safe for United Fruit. It is what it is.
Man, I've always wondered about something. You know, it seems like if I was an executive ordering the death of villagers with Hessians or hitmen or something like that, these little, you know, Blackwater death squads or whatever, you know, I'm wondering, how is it that they sleep so deeply at night? I mean, aren't they afraid of retaliation at some point?
Oh, that's what the bodyguards are for. Right?
I suppose.
But then again, it's also that old Gould statement about I can get half of the working class to fight the other half of the working class. Wasn't that Gould?
I think we're sort of the manifestation of that with our teabaggers and everything else. They're the ones with the guns. You know? And they're always seeing phantoms. I mean, it's like there's like a cartoon I'd like to make of them. It's just, they're like little projectors. You know, they project onto everything around them the most god-awful, fearsome things. I mean, you remember, they even had them, you know, afraid of Girl Scouts. You know, or paranoid about the Girl Scouts, things like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, that's why the teabaggers are given the targets they're given. They're always given soft targets. It's easy to go and intimidate, you know, say, or try to intimidate, say, Planned Parenthood. Acorn was a soft target. Because in both instances, you've got constituencies primarily made up of the poor. And the poor can always be beaten up. I mean, you can go back to 14th century France and find time after time absolute slaughters of the poor if they stood up and complained about how they were being treated. It's a time-tested strategy that works, Grant.
Makes all the more savory a burning castle, I think.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Pitchforks, torches.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I mentioned the other night that I've been enjoying the heck out of the second season of Alpha House over on Amazon Prime.
Alpha House?
Yeah. This is not a paid endorsement. But I watched an episode from the second season last night called Shelter in Place. And your mention of the teabaggers brought it to mind. The whole thing is hilarious if you like politics. I mean, it's Gary Trudeau and his production staff absolutely have a field day with the Republicans because the four main characters are all Republican senators.
Oh, wonderful.
And I don't want to give anything away. But if you ever want to see teabaggers get skewered comically in a series, Shelter in Place, Season 2 of Alpha House on Amazon Prime is a great place to start.
Alpha House. I'll look it up.
Yeah, and, John Goodman leads the ensemble cast, so how bad.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And Wanda Sykes is in it. So it's got a lot to recommend it. And
that's the thing; they could probably view that and not even know they're being skewered.
Oh, I don't know. I thought at one point about going around and seeing if I could find some right wing hissy fits being had about it. And I'm sure they've got to be out there because if for no other reason than that episode alone. Let's just put it this way: John Goodman repeating the line, "God damn teabaggers." I'm working on a way of trying to reduce that to a clip so I can just add it to the lineup. Goddamn teabaggers. Or dumbass teabaggers or something like that.
Well, that's pretty much all I had to report today. I wanted to bring that speech to your attention because I think he really nailed a lot of things, and I think it sets the record straight in opposition to what the Western media, you know, the Ministry of Truth has come up with.
Right.
And
it is fascinating reading, and it doesn't come across like some screaming apologia or, it reads, the piece itself reads rather scholarly.
Well, you know, I get the impression he's got a very level head and a very cool hand, and he knows he's got, you know, certain options, and he knows he's got certain things on his side, and I don't think he's not in a panic, and he's not in a hurry. And I think that counts for a lot when you're in that level of sort of the high-stakes games of international politics. Being able to hold your hand for a while is a very enviable position. I mean, look at us. We're flailing all over the fucking place.
Empire of chaos.
Yep.
And anyway, if you read the Project for a New American Century, Grant, they kind of admit that's what they want.
Yes, endless war. Great for the weapons industry.
But it's all predicated on us doing it right.
They're doomed.
That's really the key to the benefits program, exactly. Well, Grant, it's awfully good to hear from you. Don't ever hesitate. I mean, if you feel a good Grant rant coming on, everybody's game.
Sure. Well, you know, I find other ways to sort of let the steam out slowly these days, I guess. Never quite builds to that pitch. So.
Well, that's probably healthy.
Used to.
Well, howdy.
Used to go off all the time. Anyway, I'll let you go.
All right, take care, Grant.
Cheers, Bob.
Bye now. Our buddy Grant, Mr. Gibson in the chat room. And, yeah, that is an interesting read for anybody who wants to jump in and it's a lengthy read, but a very good read. It is over at Club Orlov, cluborlov.blogspot.fi. And it is, it's worth the effort. Let's go over to the Gizmo line, 304-663-HORN, 663-4676. The Skype line is open, 304-574-8178. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
There you are, Bill. What's going on?
Oh, man, you guys are getting me wild when you start talking the Russian situation. I'll just throw a line at you and let you finish it. From Skatina in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic. What happened right after World War II?
An Iron Curtain has descended across the face of Eastern Europe.
Ah, yes. I'm proud that somebody else in the world knows about that, yeah.
Well, I was required to learn that as a freshman in college.
Ooh.
Because it had been repeated at the auditorium, that was not, you know, a quarter mile's walk from my dormitory.
What university was that?
Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri.
Okay. And that was, of course, Mr. Churchill.
Yeah, who was speaking very much ex cathedra and had the UK Foreign Office in an apoplectic frenzy when he said that.
Well, he was out of power, was he not, at that point?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so, yeah. And, you know, and of course, when you hold up Joseph Stalin to the world, the capitalists couldn't have found a better somebody to say, hey, we want to be like him. Because his track record was pretty poor, wasn't it?
Well, yeah.
For human endeavors.
It's a pity, and I don't know exactly the nature of your software, and I know you've got computer problems as it is, but it's a pity.
Oh, if you could get
a reader that would read this thing to you, it would blow your mind, this piece that Grant sent along.
Yeah, that's the problem. If I can pull it up to a certain spot, this reader could handle it. It can handle most everything, but I have to blow the thing up so big that you know, it's really hard to get through. My FA is so high in the reading echelon of life when I was a kid. This really antagonizes the hell out of me. Reading was, if there was something to be learned about, I could get a book and start learning about it. That's what, you know, on, working on this thing right now, and it's just developed in Western France that a gap has appeared between von Kluck and this other von Below. They're always drilling the officers general in World War One with von somebody, you know. Which, what does it mean, from? Is, I don't know what it was. It was a tag that they got that was an honor of some kind. Can you tell me what that was?
Not sure.
Like they weren't Joe Schmidt anymore. They were Joseph von Schmidt.
Oh, but yeah. The Prussian von to the name.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the honorific. I wanted to share a couple of things here with you because I think from this piece, since you won't have access to it, just check this out, Bill. These are points that were gathered together by a Russian blogger by the name of Chipstone. And point one, Russia will no longer play games and engage in backroom negotiations over trifles, but Russia is prepared for serious conversations and agreements if these are conducive to collective security, are based on fairness, and take into account the interests of each side. Two, and wow, this one, wow. Two, all systems of global collective security now lie in ruins. There are no longer any international security guarantees at all, and the entity that destroyed them has a name, the United States of America.
Yeah. Well, NATO was designed at first to be a bulwark against Stalin, because Stalin had everybody cowed. That he was the most evil man. He was the one of the three of the Japanese Empire and the Germans and the Russians. The only ones left were the Russians, and they had been our friends. Thank somebody. He just hit him right on the head. They won that European war. They really used to. They were going to basic map and start following the amount of miles that they fought over and. Places like Leningrad, where the people were literally starving to death. They had no cats left. They had to bring cats in, and Jim talked about that, too. They had to bring a whole bunch of cats into Leningrad because the rats were... And then they fed the damn city, this lake, Ladoga, or Ladoga, whatever the hell it was, when it froze, the Russians built an ice road. And it wasn't on TV. It wasn't the Ice Road Truckers, you know.
Right.
That's how they were able to keep that city alive. This guy, Vaslov, a captured Soviet officer who he raised an army of about 100,000 who fought against Hitler. I mean, against Stalin. I mean, it's like, what a roll of the dice, you know, between Stalin and Hitler, you roll the dice. But, as you mentioned, the current leader did have KGB leanings, but is he just trying to keep his nation in one piece? I mean, is the whole world?
No, I don't think he's really. I don't think he's quite as lammy as that piece makes him out to be.
Yeah.
You know, if you just apply the principle from Thucydides that great nations do as they wish and small nations do as they must, from the Melian dialogue, he's not gonna run out there and yell Bruga Bruga Bruga, you know, I'm gonna get you. He's gonna soft pedal it.
Well, I can't believe what I heard coming out of people's mouths. About going to war for the Ukraine. Have you people forgotten that the people on the other side have a whole crap load of weapons that can, you talk about peace on Earth. No, we don't have pieces of the Earth. A little piece there, a lot of peace floating over here, and, you know. And, of course, they had their own nuclear disaster, didn't they?
Sure, but well, the larger, oddly enough, all of that Ukraine foolishness, and by foolishness I mean any notions of going toe to toe with the Ruskies, as they say in Dr. Strangelove, that kind of went by the boards when we decided that our boogeyman of the week had become ISIL. So then we had to start going, booga, 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 ISIL.
Well, when I look at ISIL, I see the two big types of Islam, the two big, it's like Catholics versus Muslims, you know? What are the two types of Islam that are? Iran has one huge type.
You mean Sunni and Shia?
Yeah, I must say Sufi. Yeah, Shia. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, Sunni. Well, and there are off and then they have their individual offshoots, and for instance, the people of ISIL are Salafists, and oddly enough, their enemies, the Saudi royal house. Well, Wahhabism is Salafist as well, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, and that comes straight out of Saudi Arabia. Don't they encourage the hell out of that?
Mm-hmm.
Our allies, the Saudis. Yeah. They're our allies, and while we have to... But I've heard that our oil situation is much better than it was. I mean, when I was a kid, they were capping. They were capping oil wells out west, Oklahoma, Texas. I think we imported a lick of oil in the 1950s, do you?
I'm not sure. I don't know.
Well, when this stuff comes back to Earth, it's all about the money, as we used to say. Follow the money. And I have some support for the Korean situation only because the North Korean regime is just pitiful and kind of dangerous. And it's a family-oriented dictatorship. That's communism, my ass. That's just old style. Keep it in the family, just like the guy in Haiti. The old man died, and the kid couldn't keep control over it. In fact, the son just died recently, didn't he?
Which?
What? Haitian ruler.
Duvalier.
Yeah, Duvalier. Good French name, huh? Yes. And that's old style dictatorship. And South Korea, I think, well, the UN actually did something that the League of Nations had been torn apart when I was a kid. I don't know what you learned about the League of Nations.
What I was taught about the League of Nations was that the League of Nations came to nothing because the United States wouldn't participate.
Yep. Who was that? He was in New England. His kid was vice president under Nixon for a while. It was an old family in Boston. It was an old money family. I can't keep the Dulles brother names out of my mind because they were such a behind-the-scenes powerhouse in the day. Well, I mean, Mike wasn't the greatest president we ever had, but when you get on that interstate, you know?
Yes. But understand the Republican Congress that passed the National Highway Defense Act, or whatever it was called, that created the interstates and was signed into law by Eisenhower, who wanted it in the first place because he had seen the autobahns of Germany during the Second World War, that they never managed to completely bomb into uselessness because they were so well built. The Republican Party of today would not be capable of doing that, Bill. The Republican Party of today hates the idea of public spending for the public good. The only thing the Republican Party wants to do now is benefit its benefactors, to wit, the Koch brothers and the Sheldon Adelsons and the various and sundry other ideologically insane right-wing billionaires.
The thing that boggles my mind, these people cannot seem to get enough money. Maybe you talk about flying off on a rocket ship. That may be somewhere in the back of their minds. go find a place they haven't destroyed yet and do it again.
Well, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of minerals out in the asteroids. Don't you think for a minute that they're not working on it? Yeah, as Texas Betsy points out, the Republican Party not only won't build roads, the Republican Party can't even keep a paved road paved anymore.
Yes. Yeah, you notice that too. I don't drive it at all anymore. I don't travel like I used to, you know, which was constant. I mean, I did so many trips between Cleveland and Detroit, I can probably walk the damn thing if I had to, if I could get that far. It just, this, you know, that's the bottom line is why I'm so conscious of, just like you, World War One and on. That's when the shit started to hit the fan in 1914. And it hasn't stopped flying yet. To Putin, I would hope that he's, I don't know, do you feel threatened by the guy?
No, but then again, there's a lot of stuff that I don't feel threatened by. I don't feel threatened by Ebola either, but I am getting a flu shot.
Well, I get those, yeah, the old flu and the cold shot, yeah. I don't know why, but and hell,
I'm not scared one damn bit of ISIL or ISIS. I can come up. Let's put it this way. If Fox News TV Radio Rwanda is suggesting I should be afraid of it, I take that as a sterling recommendation that I completely ignore it.
Yeah.
And you can also add to that ABC, CBS, you know, the alphabet soups. I got stuff to be afraid of. I'm afraid of the coming winter. Because if it's just, I'm afraid of the coming winter because I have a very hard time keeping this house warm. And if it's as cold as it was last winter, it's going to be a booger. And that's, you know, that's immediate and existential for me. You know, what do I worry about? I worry about keeping the horn alive into the next month. But I don't worry about it. But I don't worry about Ebola.
I'm not too worried about it. I haven't, my passport won't take me that far, neither with my money. So, but, you know, there's this idea of coal. I remember, the only thing I remember about coal when I was a kid was everybody bitched about the price of a ton of coal. And, you know, so in my mind as a 5 or 6 year old, I thought, well, coal is great, man. It keeps you warm. But you hit it on my head. What do we use to keep the nation warm? I mean, atomic energy, oh, they sold us that, too. In fact, my buddy, whose father was a German submariner, when he built a model of the Nautilus as a young kid, his father looked at it and said he had seen German drawings of submarines that looked just like it on the outside, at least, you know. If you don't take the money and run, take what this guy has and improve upon it. And, of course, I was a Volkswagen freak from the word go. I loved the damn little bastards. Dangerous little thing. But women who, you know how many women I know who were driving Corvairs in the 1960s?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, they were a popular car with young women. When you look behind the wheel and you saw this gorgeous young lady driving this thing, and you talked to them about their Corvairs, and they liked them. Of course, nobody realized. I mean, I realized.
And then, of course, there was the Volkswagen Karmann Ghia.
Oh yeah, I had one of those.
Those were just as cute, yeah, just and you know, spiffy and swift and mid-engine. And you'll notice, I don't know if you paid much attention.
No, it was a rear engine, Bob.
Was it rear engine? Okay, yeah.
It's a Porsche. A lot of Porsches were mid-engine cars.
Well, mid-engines have come back in a big way.
Pardon?
Mid-engines have come back in a big way.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, I have often thought about it when I'm driving that bug. I head on a collision and I get an engine in the front, all right, but it's the other guy's car and it's pitting me to the seat, you know?
Yeah.
course, I would have lost a lot of weight then. I would have been thin for a change.
My father always objected to the Beetle on the principle that one was driving with the gas tank in one's lap.
You got a point there because, you talk about a coal car in the winter. And a lot of guys were using auxiliary heaters. And they were gas-fired heaters. And I kept thinking, I don't want that in my lap. Same thing you just said.
Yeah. I had a cousin once who had a little MG midget, and for heat in the winter, he would literally build bonfires out of matches in the ashtray.
Oh, man. Well, we tried it. I tried everything. I had an electric heater that I'd plug in when the thing was parked. And I went and bought a 66 in the 90s because I had some pictures of that thing parked in front of the Euclid Tavern, because I used to store my equipment there, and on a Wednesday, all I had to do was go in and unsheathe everything. It looked like Marley the Ghost, and set it up and go to work, and then drive home in a car. And then I didn't use the truck unless I had to travel on the weekend, you know. Because I played that Euclid twice a week, Wednesday and Saturday, for 20 years. It was I lived on a second floor. Great place to live after a divorce, but I'll tell you, I saw that when people talk about the sexual revolution, I just shake my head up and down. It sure was. It sure happened. And I lost interest in it with my second marriage. You finally grow up, you know. And plus, this illness came along from nowhere. And there's a lot of theories about AIDS, too. About where it came from, and you know, and we know for sure that the cocaine influx in this country, it had a backing from money somewhere. When you mentioned we got into Central America, all of a sudden you could find coke faster than you could go, just about you could find reefer, you know.
Yeah.
And reefer is a good American product. Don't they grow them out of that in Kentucky?
They're not exactly not growing it here either, Bill.
I'm glad to hear that. Of all the drugs on the market, that is a. Well, I heard Goldwater. Goldwater used to get on with Jay, what's his name, at night toward the end of his days, and he would talk about. He grew up in Arizona, you know.
Yeah.
And he just shook his head about a reefer. It was so common in Arizona. He was an old man. He said when he was young, it was. So common, it wasn't funny.
Because it's a weed.
I just don't know. Your theory on Putin can actually enclose this. Do you see him as a danger to this country?
No.
I don't either. And I know Ukraine, and I'll ask you, I think you know how much wheat the Ukraine produces.
You know what, Bill? It doesn't have a damn thing to do with wheat. There is a reason that we urged the Ukraine to engage in the economic stimulus of fracking. There's gas. And this country is hydrocarbon mad.
Yep, they can't seem to get enough of it. They don't want to look past it. Because if they look past it, these guys would start coming up with other ideas that would, as usual, they would dominate it and they'd make the money, but that's what I'm so sad by nuclear power not being what we were taught it was in the 1950s. Because on paper, theoretically, you know, you can create all this power. But you can't get rid of it. That's the problem there. And Fukushima is, I haven't heard much about it lately. What are you hearing about the situation there?
There's not a hell of a lot coming out. You have to go and look for it, but it's... I mean, that's why I went ahead and mentioned that August report that I'd had in the stack. It's an ongoing disaster, and TEPCO and no one else, for that matter, has the first freaking clue how to deal with it. And that's one of the and that's why nuclear power generally is a an act in haste, repent at leisure industry, because nobody knows what to do with a core on the floor.
Yep.
Nobody knows what to do with the millions of tons of radioactive water dumping every day into the Pacific Ocean. I mean, what do you do? Okay, we're going to capture that water and shoot it into space?
Jesus God.
I mean, because who are you going to take that? Who are you going to, you know, no, I mean, Pacific Ocean's really big. You know, we'll just let all the radiation go into that and it'll dilute. No, it doesn't.
Nope.
Not in the least.
You're going to get a hell of a lot of pre-cooked salmon, aren't you?
Ceviche on the fin, right?
Yes, because I like salmon, and I've been buying it lately and eating a lot of it, but it's farm-raised salmon. You have much of that?
I've had the farm-raised, but the thing is, farm-raised, wild-caught, you're still up to your eyeballs in mercury, and you can't eat it more than once a month.
Yep.
Or else you start reciting Lewis Carroll verse. Unintentionally.
Well, the fishermen, we were getting warned about fish, and I was fishing a long way. I was caught a Chautauqua. I love Chautauqua. It was only 2.5 hours from my house. And then Rice Lake in Canada had some of the biggest damn bluegill you ever saw in your life. And they're good eating fish, too, but those days are over, you know?
Yeah.
Can't go home with 24 pounds of fish like they used to frozen.
No, and I saw an article earlier today, I think in Salon, talking about the fact that shrimp. You know, I love shrimp. I adore shrimp. The fresher, the better.
I just ate a lot yesterday. You didn't mention that. Yeah.
Well, according to this article, significant because there was a survey done of. I mean, they did DNA testing on stuff that was labeled shrimp. And things that were labeled wild or, versus farm-raised, no. I think at least a quarter of the time they weren't what they said they were, and another significant percentage wasn't the species that it was supposed to be.
A lot of it's coming out of Southeast Asia now.
Yeah.
And China, from what I've heard with some of the fish, the way they raise them in ponds, and I don't want to sound like an anti-Chinese human being, because it's not that at all. It's just...
No, look, I always laugh at anybody who refers anymore to the communist Chinese, because it is far more appropriate to refer to them as the authoritarian capitalist Chinese. And capitalism
yes.
is running wild in China now.
Yeah. Yeah. They had to put nets up around one place where some of the people were jumping. Because they're working them like,
I forget which plant it was, but yeah, they were committing, workers were committing suicide, so they put nets up.
It's hunger, you know.
I mean, there's a reason the Chinese bought Smithfield Meats. They need our pork production.
Yes.
Because there's a story a week about somebody getting caught in China selling rat as pork.
Oh, great! What was the big pork producer? They had a big yacht parked at Norfolk. It was one of the big pork companies. Dangerfield.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They had a huge, like a 65-foot boat, and I was fascinated. I was down there. I was on a trip from here and stopping at a couple Civil War battlefields and heading for the Outer Banks. When, in fact, I could look out the back window of the place that... I was staying, and there was the Wright Brothers monument looking at me. And the only nice thing there, they took out fishing over the wrecks. Because I think Cape Hatteras had a reputation for wrecks, don't they?
Yes, yes.
Didn't they pull up part of the original monitor out of there?
No, I think that was a little further north. Well, no, it was kind of off Cape Hatteras, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The storms. It was, I don't know where they were sending that thing. They were sending it from Virginia somewhere down south. But, it's maybe Charleston. because, you know, I was a big seizure Charleston by sea for many years. The Navy had a ton of ships down there just knocking the hell out of everything in Charleston they could hit. Because they had their, you know, Fort Dumter was actually a cause of the war, you know. And you take that back again, it was like, are you kidding me? Charleston fell when Sherman's people marched across their supply lines, and like having somebody walk across your windpipe, you know. You don't get supplies, you don't get this and that, you're hurting bad. And that damn blockade was the big thing, and of course the British did the same thing to Germany in World War One, and of course that, you know what that brought about? Brought about the use of the U-boat. And then they sank one ship too many with the Lusitania, and that was bad. Well, I'll clear the line, but yeah, this Putin, I haven't quite figured out whether I should be afraid of this guy, or is he just speaking because the Black Sea, well, who was it? Our vice president, the creep. The guy walking around with somebody else's heart, you know him?
Richard C., big time Dick Cheney.
Cheney wanted to introduce United States warships into the Black Sea.
Because that'd be a great idea.
Of course.
You know, I started the program, Bill, talking a little bit about the standards for taking someone into custody for mental illness or for quarantine purposes. Now, if you ever wanted to see somebody who should be taken away and examined for signs of deep and abiding mental illness, because sociopathy and psychopathy are mental illnesses, Dick Cheney's that guy. I mean, yeah, suffers from a mental illness and is a threat to others. We've got proof. I mean, the guy should be in a locked ward somewhere, if not at The Hague.
Well, the British tried to get in and control the entrance to the Black Sea, the Dardanelles, which is one reason why Germany was happy to get Turkey as an ally, because they closed it off and ended up in a little misfortune in a place called Gallipoli.
Yep.
And that was a mess. I mean, these guys in World War One, they couldn't run around fast enough creating new messes, you know?
Right.
Well, let's try here. Let's try there. And the Italians and the Austrians were fighting over a couple miles of land in the Alps. And they could put a million men down there as casualties between those two, you know. They couldn't find enough ways to kill other human beings. It just, the more I read, the more I learn, the more I just sit here and you keep shaking your head. They couldn't have been that rotten. My God, they could be. Anyway, I'll let you go and clear the line for somebody else. But yeah, you hit it tonight. You, when you're talking about Putin because one of my best friends is of Ukrainian descent, and we've talked about it. Is it helping the average Ukrainian or hurting him? And he feels that the chaos is hurting everybody, and that is usually the right answer to this kind of stuff. The chaos is in itself a walking death trap. Anyway, take care of yourself.
All right, we'll see you, Bill. Take care. Bye.
Good night.
Mr. Stress, our buddy Bill, calling from Cleveland. We're gonna take a little bit of a veer away from some of the more serious topics. You may recall that Senator Lindsey Graham cracker had declared a couple of weeks ago that he might just run for president. Mm-hmm. Hadn't completely made up his mind. He's going to worry about it tomorrow. Well, he apparently decided to talk about his presidential ambitions with some folks in Charleston at the Hibernian Society. Remember, Scarlett's last name was O'Hara. Oh, my God. This is not a parody. This is not a joke. I mean, this is not from The Onion or anything. there really is an outfit called the Hibernian Society in Charleston, South Carolina, and they really did invite Lindsey Graham to come in and give them a good talking to. Oh, dear. I guess his handlers were off at the barbecue at 12 Oaks.
I'm sorry the government's so f***ed up. If I get to be president, white men who are in male-only clubs are going to do great in my presidency. We got any Presbyterians here? Good predestined. We got any Baptists? They're the ones that drink and don't admit it. Baptists who can't read.
Yeah, I know the audio was not the best. The Hibernian Society in 2014, yes, the second decade of the 21st century, amen. The Hibernian Society of Charleston, South Carolina is an all-male society. So Lindsey shows up on the invitation and says, if I get to be president, white men who are in male-only clubs are going to do great in my presidency. Mm-hmm. Yes. No, he really said that. White men who are in male-only clubs are going to do great in my presidency. I'll bet they will. I just bet they bless your heart. God love you, Lindsey. Mercy sakes. Because that's the only way he can, being president is the only way that Lindsey can keep ISIL from killing. They're going to get us all killed. Fiddle-dee-dee. But he was right. Baptists are the ones who drink and just won't admit it. Oh, Lindsey. Just butching it up a little bit there for the Hibernian Society, don't you know? Yeah. Great googly moogly. Oh, and a little bit of, well, so I got up this morning and through the miracle of the Internet was... Ray writing in, well, he's got Ann Coulter's vote. Yeah, because remember, Ann Coulter thinks women shouldn't be allowed to vote. Good God. So, now, anyway, I woke up this morning to the earth-shattering and stunning news that Apple CEO Tim Cook is gay. Now, I watched for a good long while after and still could not for the life of me figure out why I was supposed to care or why a gay person was supposed to care. Oh, well. So, naturally, once, and this is the fun part. Once the earth-shattering, groundbreaking news of Tim Cook's gayness had got out, well, let's say you're a booker for a morning news program, or a news program generally. What's your first thought? We got the news that, we got the video of Tim, and we've got the statement here of Tim Cook saying that he's gay. We need somebody to comment on it. Oh, I know! Let's call Ted Cruz. Really? The Cubanadian? Son of Raphael? The man who has been anointed to be king of America? I only say that because it's true. His daddy anointed Ted's little old Hayde with some Crisco or some such, to be king of America. Mm-hmm. Had the reverb on and everything. Now, why anyone would care what Ted Cruz... Because Ted Cruz is a homophobe in the first place. You know, he thinks music with more than 100 beats per minute can just straight up give you the gay. Tell us about it, Ted. Old, tired, slow computers. Oh, well. You're going to love this, I promise. Because of the language that he uses. It's precious. Gay folks in the Horn Family Commune Congregation and allies and friends thereof, which pretty much makes up the entire Horn Family Commune Congregation, you might want to get the hockey puck and the duct tape out.
Keep social issues or bedroom issues out of the election from here on out?
Well, look, you're right that the Tea Party's focus is almost exclusively fiscal and economic. In fact, T stands for taxed enough already.
Right.
And, you know, if you go to any Tea Party rally, you see people who are focused on free market principles in the country.
No, I see people who can't spell. Obama is the Antichrist! No, they show up, and they're kind of, no, Ted, you liar. They're all hung up on their guns, too. But anyway.
Constitution. And that is the existential threat facing this country. Now, listen, there are a great many social conservatives are concerned about directions in this country, and I think they have a legitimate part of this debate.
No, they don't. They're bigots.
But I'll tell you what, with the threat that is bankrupting our kids and grandkids, is the attitude. Control debt is the size, power, and spending of the federal government, and is the...
Ted, has nobody told you the deficit is shrinking wildly? It's a non-issue for everybody except you and the spirochetes in your brain? Or are those parakeets? I get them confused.
Intrusions of the federal government on our constitutional liberties, and those are issues that bring people together across parties, across income lines, across racial lines, across ages. People want to protect our constitutional liberty.
Oh, the Senator, you yourself have talked about introducing anti-gay marriage legislation, trying to protect the rights of the states, you've said. But at the same time, you've also said that what the Supreme Court did by not ruling on the states who have allowed gay marriage, that was tragic and indefensible.
You are exactly right. Look, I believe in the Constitution. I think we need to fight.
No, you don't. You filthy liar. You're a theocrat. You're a theocrat who believes in Ted Cruz, anointed future king of America. But they're not going to bring up daddy anointing your little old head and calling you king of America. Now, are they over there at CNBC? Oh, hell no.
Follow the Constitution. What the Supreme Court did, effectively striking down the laws of 30 states, was wrong, and it was judicial activism.
But if
so was it wrong when the Supreme Court struck down anti-miscegenation statutes in Loving versus Virginia? Because it's the same thing, Ted.
State chooses right to allow people of the same sex to marry. Shouldn't they be allowed to do that?
Yes. No, I agree. Perhaps you are not understanding my position. Yeah. Marriage is a question for the states.
If it's a question for the states, then it's a question for the federal government, too. But even if it's a question for the states, it's a question for the states that must be answered within the framework of the ideas of equal protection and due process. And if the state enacts laws regarding marriage that violate notions of equal protection, then those laws are void. You'd think a guy that got all the way through Harvard Law School and everybody and told everybody how smart he was would have figured that little tidbit out, but oh hell no.
The Federalist system. Marriage has been a question for the states since the beginning of this country.
Well, what's your position if you were running a specific state, though? That's the issue.
Actually, Andrew, with all respect, it's not the issue. The issue is constitutionally, should the federal government or federal courts impose their policy views in the place of the policy views of citizens of states? Look, we've got 50...
No! The question is, do we have a constitution? Does the constitution guarantee the equal protection of the laws to every citizen of this country, period? If the answer is yes, then no state can enact a law that says a certain class of citizen cannot enjoy the equal protection of the law, which is what DOMA laws do. It's another one of those moments where I wish, I do wish there was a real God out there with a little lightning bolt finger that could just, you know, and goodbye, Ted! And the big booming voice comes down and says, I do that to filthy liars sometimes. But there ain't, so it doesn't happen.
50 states. The citizens of New York decide they want gay marriage. They have the constitutional authority to make that decision. And if the citizens of Texas or South Carolina or Florida decide they want to maintain traditional marriage between one man and one woman...
Bullshit traditional marriage. There were no goats involved. There was no sheep swapping. No camel leasing. There's your traditional biblical marriage. And even when there were no camels, sheep, or goats involved, there were exchanges of money, dowry, dower interests. Those predate the United States, Ted.
They have that constitutional authority. You know, Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis referred to laboratories of democracy. You've got 50 states where we can have, in each state, the laws reflect the values and mores of the citizens of those
states.
Yeah, what happens when the laboratory of democracy is being run by a guy who just walks around in nothing but a lab coat going, you know, crazy? Yeah, so he did say, and I don't know where it is in that clip, but along the way, Ted Cruz says that he's okay with Tim Cook's personal choice. You know, because one day... Tim Cook just woke up and said, I am so gay. Just like Ted Cruz wakes up every morning and says, oh, really? I'm hetero. I'm sure of it. And then goes off whistling show tunes to the shower. Let's go to the Skype line. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello?
Oh, you said Skype. I'm not on Skype.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, you're on the Skype line.
Oh, okay. I know. You know what? I dropped off the program for a while, so I guess that's the new gizmo and whatnot. Okay. Anyway, I'm calling from South Carolina, and what is going on with Lindsey Graham's handlers? Because as far as I understand it, the Hibernians, they're aligned with the Irish cops. That's like an Irish cop.
Hey, it's an Irish Catholic organization that was founded in the 1830s.
Yeah. You know, I mean, they were all the cop dudes where I'm from, they were all hooked up with them. You know, they rent out the festival hall and they get drunk and they beat up people when they go home and all that kind of shit.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't even know. Like, nobody told him that.
I don't think he much cares. He's a Republican. If he says stupid things about white guys are going to do great under my administration, then it's okay because he's a Republican and we expect him to talk like that.
Yeah, well, it's somewhat unsettling because if you see the ads, I don't watch that much TV, but the production and the ads that he's showing here, I mean, it looks like some Hollywood stuff. He has way too much money for his message because apparently he and his senile buddy from Arizona, they're kind of behind this ISIL-ISIS thing, you know. They were on the side of it. And you don't hear that on the mainstream news, but it's the absolute truth.
I mean, John McCain's never met a war he didn't like. And Lindsay's there, right by his side. He is Barnacle Boy to McCain's Mermaid Man. To bring SpongeBob into the equation.
Okay. Oh boy.
But the undercurrent of all this is the idea that Lindsay snuck out of the closet long enough to go tell a bunch of guys in a guys only group that he was crazy about guys and white guys and guys only, and would continue to be crazy about him in the White House. Whoop! I mean, yeah, there's a reason Charlie Pierce calls him Senator Butch Me Up.
Well, yeah, that was the funny part. He was like, I'm going to let my hair down. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, and if the thing is, just be genuine. I don't, you know, if you're gay, you're gay. Don't try to front.
Well, no, but come on, you're in South Carolina. Tell me what's going to happen the day Lindsay comes out.
Well, that'll be it. That's it.
I mean, he'll just, and he probably won't even be able to get a cushy job at the Heritage Foundation.
He won't be able to sit on Jim Demented's lap, huh?
No, and I can't imagine he'd be particularly welcome, you know, on the board at PFLAG either, for that matter.
Well.
Or the Human Rights Campaign.
What do you think is going to happen? You talked about Ted. Now, how did he attain this much perceived power? I don't see where he has any power, but apparently he does as a freshman congressman. Is he still a freshman?
Who, McCain?
No, I fast forwarded too far.
Oh, to Cruz?
Yeah.
No, he has perceived power because he has a perceived power base, to wit, the teabaggers. If you take the aggregate of all the IQs of the Tea Party movement, there's not an average IQ amongst them, but IQ is not, proof of IQ is not required to vote, so he's got a bunch of idiots who are willing to vote for him. I mean, he got elected senator.
His cohort doesn't even know he has a French name. Louis Gomer? He doesn't even know it's a French name.
No, that's Gomer.
Stop it.
It hurts a little, don't it? Although it would be fun to see him interviewed on some program where they would say, and we have with us now the representative from the 1st District of Texas. Good afternoon, Congressman Gomer.
To which he
would say, why are you casting aspersions on my asparagus?
That's exactly what I was going to say. He's so predictable, isn't he? I just can't, you know, the fact that he was in charge of people's futures and whatnot as a judge, even a magistrate judge, just to disturbs me. It really disturbs me.
Oh, I think if I'd been imprisoned by Louis Gomer, which he will be from now on, thank you, I would file habeas corpus saying that I have been imprisoned by a madman or an idiot.
It's terrible. So I have a quick question for you.
Okay.
What do you think is going to happen in this election? And do you really think that these scoundrels are going to take the House and the Senate?
I think on Wednesday, November the 5th, the sun will rise. I mean, that's a euphemism. The earth will turn back into the face of the sun. And that's about all I'm certain about. I'll be honest, if the Republicans take the Senate, but do not take, but if they, you know, let's say they take it 51-49. Then they will do their mischief, and Harry Reid will be in the position of having to adopt the scorched earth policies of Mitch McConnell. Will he do that? We don't know. I suspect not. So what the worst case scenario is that you get a bunch of batshit crazy bills out of the House and the Senate that land on President Not Sure's desk. Then the question becomes one of, will Barack Obama be willing to spend the two lame duck years of his presidency just vetoing things? Because he's going to have to. Now, specifically, what do I think? What would I expect to see from an entirely Republican Congress? I would expect to see change CPI relative to Social Security. I would expect to see a gutting and slashing of Medicare. I would expect to see a further reduction in nutritional support to the working poor and the poorest of the poor. I would expect to see an absolute gold rush of tax giveaways. But that doesn't take a crystal ball, because that's just Republicans doing what Republicans do. I think the one thing that I think, and I get some pushback on from people, they'd never do that. They learned their lesson back in the 90s. Bullshit they did. I think you'll see the impeachment of Barack Hussein Obama.
Mm-hmm. I could see that.
They've already got the votes in the House to do it. The only reason the House hasn't done it until now is because it would be a moot point, because it would be sent to a Senate that would have been unwilling to even take it up and wouldn't have to. But if there's a Republican majority, they can at least take it up and try him so that they can say that the last two Democratic presidents have been impeached and tried in the Senate. Because remember, even though Bill Clinton got off, and, well, probably shouldn't use that phrase, he was tried in the Senate. It wasn't much of a trial, but he was tried in the Senate.
Well, it is my hope that the sane Republicans, I would hope, would bicker between the crazy Tea Party people.
Assuming facts not in evidence. Before you use a phrase like the sane Republicans, you're going to have to point me toward one.
I don't have that much time, Bob, all right?
No, you think there are that many sane Republicans in the Senate?
Well, I'm trying to be nice. I'm really trying to.
I think they will happily have their little trial. And it'll be for Benghazi and IRS and probably wearing a tan suit. I mean, we are talking about the political creatures who have absolutely no regard for the rule of law whatsoever. I mean, I just played that clip from Ted Cruz, and the man is supposed to be a constitutional law genius because he went to Harvard and stuff. But it's clear from what he says that he doesn't. I mean, that's at best a C constitutional law student in the state university I went to, claiming that the Supreme Court doesn't have the right to rule that a statute is obnoxious to the Equal Protection Clause. You can't make it out of first year law school talking like that. But by God, once you become a senator, game on.
Well, he has his minions fooled. Of course, he always makes platitudinal. I'm going to make up a word. Platitudinal statements like that. Because I'm not in law school, I can make up words. You know what I mean?
Well, see, I don't think he's got them fooled. I think he's telling them what they want to hear. Because that whole clip was nothing but dog whistling.
I just think this Ebola nonsense and Ferguson verdict coming, which I don't feel very positive about. I think it's going to be harmful. It's going to be really harmful for regular normal people.
Well, this country's in terrible trouble, and it's only going to get worse. I mean, you wanted the scenario of what happens if the Republicans take over the Congress. What happens if the Senate remains in Democratic hands? That means we get two more years of what we've had 6 years of.
We still can't do anything. We need to purse strings. We need to be able to move forward.
We need a purge of the Republican Party. And I'm not talking about violence. I'm talking about somebody in the Republican Party standing up and saying, I want my party. You know, they talk about we want to take our country back. I want somebody there, and see, this is the same problem with those sane Republicans we were talking about a few minutes ago. I want somebody who will stand up and take his party back.
Well, I was trying to be nice, but now, in slight retrospect, we had a couple guys that retired, and they were like, you know, to hell with it. This is not what I signed up for. These people are crazy. We're not getting anything done. I can't recall their names, but I do remember the interviews. It's really sad.
I mean, this is a Republican Party that thinks Pat Roberts of Kansas is not conservative enough. This is a Republican Party that thinks that Thad Cochran of Mississippi is some sort of quisling collaborator with the Democrats. Good God! This is a Republican Party where Susan Collins of Maine is a moderate, when the woman's never cast a moderate vote in her life. I mean, my senator, allegedly a Democrat, Joe Manchin, was out there the other day on TV talking about he sure dang did hope that Susan Collins got reelected when there's a progressive Democrat running against her, and he can't even speak in favor of the Democrat.
Oh, no. Yeah, I absolutely heard that on C-SPAN. Yeah. I'm more in tune to him now since I've been listening to you with the Joe Manchin nonsense. But it's really interesting how the Republicans, I'm going to generalize, but they have this mantra, you know, and you know, it's like that hackneyed term, the echo chamber. But they're very good at it. They always talk about too many regulations strangling the economy. You know, and honestly, I don't see it. I mean, I want clean air. I want fresh water. I can't stand mountaintop removal. When you learn about it, you know, and it's not that damn complicated. Just like when you were talking earlier about the DU, the depleted uranium. And that's kind of old news if you are a student of news on the Internet. You know about that. The average American doesn't even understand what the hell that is. Okay? But they do understand going to the rifle range, right? And they do understand firing their handguns. And they might not understand that they're crazy because if you go there too much without ventilation and that lead bullet is coming out and you see that smoke and you're breathing it in, that's lead. So that goes to these crazy cops also. They've got lead poisoning.
Well, personally, I think that your average gun goober was eating lead paint chips as a child off the walls. But, you know, that's me.
It's a mess. But people are just not, I don't know. I'm excited to vote. I'm excited. And the more they tell me I can't vote, guess what? I want to vote.
I mean, in a place like South Carolina, hell yes. On the other hand, though, my trip to the polls on Tuesday is going to be a real bear because my morals are at odds with my politics. And I don't know who's going to win. I honest to God don't. I got Shelley Moore Capito running for the Senate against Natalie Tennant, and neither one of them can be bothered to even acknowledge the science, not climate change, but the science that says that their own constituents are being poisoned. Neither one of them. So who do I vote for there? Then I've got a real hot race between a nasty piece of work fronted by the Koch brothers named Evan Jenkins, who's a Republican, but before that he was a Democrat, but before that he was a Republican, versus Nick Rahal, who jumps out of planes for the Friends of Coal. And neither one of them will acknowledge the fact that they are spending more time and effort representing the coal industry, the poisoners, than they are the people who are being poisoned. Which way do I cast my vote there? You tell me.
Well,
I'm not being an asshole. You tell me.
No. West Virginia and parts of Louisiana, I'm sorry, you're in the neo-colonization pickle. In other words, we colonized
and subjugate everybody we can. Now we're colonizing and subjugating our own people. And
I mean, for me, it's like and please forgive me if this comes off as I don't mean it to be insulting. For me, this is like being an indigenous person in Argentina in the 16th century trying to decide whether I want to vote for the Portuguese or the Spaniards.
Either way, you're getting killed.
Right.
Or subjugated. Yeah, right. No, I understand that. That exactly. Well, yeah. It's awful.
You know, do I prefer the rope or the hat or the axe?
What I mean, what the hell is wrong with these people? You don't even have to read. Just look at documentaries. Look at Harlan County. Look at what the Pinkertons did. I mean, it's not that fucking complicated.
No, it's not. But you can't spit without hitting a Stop Obama's War on Coal sign in this state. And I'm at a point where I am honest to Jesus, puked of it. Sick of it. I mean, I become angry at the sight of this crap. I need a vacation.
Bob, I don't know how you don't have a stroke every night on the air, honest to God.
I mean, I see a Friends of Coal sticker on a car around here, and I'm thinking, well, you dirty, rotten, poisoning, bright, stagging, not pull, frazzle-lacking. Because that's what they put that goddamn little sticker on their car, and what they're saying is, I am in favor of poisoning my neighbors.
How do you say it? That's Jobs.
Yeah, Jobs.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be, and if things turn out in this state like I expect them to turn out, I am going to be one merciless sumbitch come November 5th. All right, you bastards. Bring on the Jobs. Get them little Keebler coal elves of making more coal under the ground, because, by God, you got you some Friends of Coal. You got you some Republican coal lovers out there. Ooh-wee. Oh, it's going to be Frisbees and wheat checks for everybody. Sorry, you touched a nerve.
No, I told you, I've been there, I understand. And the daughters are in strip clubs and the guys are in the coal mines and there's no libraries and there's nothing much in between. And,
yeah.
It's sad, very sad.
You know, tonight was trick or treat because, you know, Friday it's going to be cold. And Friday nights are not good for trick-or-treat. Tonight was trick-or-treat in my little town. I had occasion to run downtown before airtime, and the little children were gathering and stuff. I saw a child wearing blue coveralls, little child coveralls that had bright, reflective orange and white stripes on them. We just call them stripes around here. With filth smudged on the child's face. The child was going out trick-or-treating as a coal miner.
Are you fucking kidding me? Like a little coal miner?
Yep.
What the hell is it good about that?
Welcome to my world.
You need to stay home for a couple of days. No, never mind. You need a vacation. Yeah.
Yeah, I need to go somewhere, listen to the ocean. Yeah.
Think about your buddy out there on the bay in the West Coast, man, when you run a sailboat.
Yeah, exactly. Let him go now, let him go now. It's perfect timing. Sparky just said, if you need a vacation, come back with Ferg. If he comes back to California, believe me, I'm thinking about it. Hey, I got to get out of here. We're at 1 minute till. Thanks for the call.
I got one quick question. Is off Frank Carroll, is it Carolyn Baker or Carol Baker? Like, there's a Carolyn that does the lifeboat hour.
No. Carol Baker. Carolbaker. Carol Baker.
She's a wonderful person.
Yes, she is. You have a good night.
Okay. You too.
Bye now. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for helping us get out of the hole, everybody who did. Thank you, one and all. And thank you, Sparky, for getting it started by pulling the pin. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acheact.org, acheact.org. And yes, always, 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 Gina. It's all for you.